Welcome to The Clever Cookster, your ultimate window into the kitchens of the world's best cooks. I'm your host, Kara Rhoda. We are so honored today to be joined by Jeremiah Tower, the legendary chef formerly of California's Chez Panisse and Stars, and more recently of New York's Tavern on the Green. He is a James Beard Award-winning cookbook author and the author of the 2003 memoir, What I Saw and Cooked at the American Culinary Revolution. Thank you so much for being here.
My pleasure to be here. Thank you very much for inviting me.
Today's sponsor is Casper Mattresses, obsessively engineered American-made mattresses at a shockingly fair price. And now you can get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/clever and using the code CLEVER. Listen, you spend about a third of your life sleeping. Let's make sure you're doing it on a good mattress. Casper brings together two comfy technologies for better nights and brighter days, latex foam and memory foam. So they've got just the right sink, just the right bounce, no matter how you sleep. They've got a risk-free trial and return policy. They'll deliver it straight to you, and you can try it for 100 days. If you're not happy, they'll pick it back up. At the store, maybe you'll get a minute to try out their mattresses, but with Casper, you'll actually get to sleep on it. It's $500 for a twin-size mattress and $950 for a king-size mattress. Comparing that to industry averages, that's an outstanding price point. So get $50 towards any mattress purchase by going to casper.com/clever and using the code CLEVER. Terms and conditions apply.
I want to talk first today about California cuisine because I feel like we've reached a point in time where a new generation of people, especially on the East Coast, is eating in a way that's so influenced by that food movement without being necessarily very conscious of it. As someone who is very involved in California cuisine from the very beginning, I was wondering if you could talk a bit about how you feel that it's impacted the way people eat today and what lessons we might have learned from it.
Well, you know, I've been credited with sort of starting it or helping to start it. But even with that, I know that most people won't believe me and never believe me when I say, for instance, when we were starting it, there were no fresh herbs. There was, in other words, any kind of market that's got everything you want now in terms of vegetables and meat and olive oils and vinegars and spices didn't exist. So what the spark was, is to say, I'm not going to use frozen food anymore. This was at Chez Panisse. We're going to go, and if we can't buy it, we'll go look for it. Maybe we can find it. And we'll only cook what we can find. In other words, a serious restaurant in those days, theoretically, was French or something, and then you had to have foie gras, but then it only came out of a can. You had to have sauces, but those were sort of out of cans, you know. So I said, we're not doing that. We're just going to cook whatever we can find around us that's fresh and wonderful. And we didn't intend that to be revolutionary, but it turned out to sort of change everything. So God help me, you know, I'm partly responsible for farm to table, that wonderful and awful term.
Well, now you can't imagine going to a restaurant that's considered high-end dining and not having the words seasonal or local involved. It's
right.
Now sort of become really hand-in-hand with the way that people think about eating good food.
Right.
What are some trends that you see in how people are cooking and eating that bother you, either that have developed out of the way that people eat now or are counter to it?
Well, the internet, you know, has obviously changed everything. But the way it's changing and has changed and changing food is fascinating because, it was fine to want to cook the way, you know, the one or two chefs in the world that you really thought were fabulous and were your mentors. But now every chef wants to cook like every other chef, and that's around the world. So you can be in Sydney or Hong Kong or Paris or London or San Francisco or Chicago or New York, and you look at the plate and you think, where am I? You know, last week I had the same thing in Hong Kong, and it looked exactly the same ingredients. And it probably has that little splooge of carrot puree across the thing, and it's got that schmear that looks like a cat's ass had been dragged across the plate. You know, I mean, come on, guys. You know, look at yourself. Wake up in the morning and say, I'm going to do my own thing.
It's sort of, in some ways, it's counter to the idea that high dining is associated with eating locally because really there is no specialization anymore. There's sort of this sense that eating locally has to look the same on every plate at every time, which is not really what it should be about.
Well, unless the whole world is the same locale, which maybe that's what's happening, you know. And local, it's like all those terms of natural and organic, they all have meaning, but they've also lost their meaning. So local, excuse me, what's local about raspberries in January in New York? I mean, come on. You know, they're flown in from Chile or Australian oysters or something. Wonderful. As a chef, I can't be happier than to have this huge world market to choose from. But, you know, stop talking about, you know, your great aunt's North 40, where the asparagus came from in January. Come on, guys.
How do you feel about meal kit subscription services, the idea that people can basically sign up to get everything they need to cook a meal as if they were making it from scratch, and they are sort of making it from scratch, but that it's already prepackaged and pre-portioned and measured, and it's really more about putting it together? Why do you think people are so compelled by that?
I don't know, because this weekend somebody brought me one, and I thought, you know, I'm the last person in the world. Well, not in the world, but I'm certainly not the sort of person to bring one to, because, you know, I don't get revved up until I go to the market and see all the things and I make up my own mind. But this thing had angelica leaves. Well, I've never seen an angelica leaf in my life. I have no idea what to do with it. And the woman who brought it to me said, oh, come on, what about the angelica? And I said, I don't know. Look it up on the internet and you tell me. So what did the angelica leaf have to do with the 2 ounces of, you know, Vermont Gruyere that they had put in a little package? And I don't get it. I mean, it's a wonderful service and it gets people really excited. And I have seen some good ones. But again, it's a sort of an idea that's become too big and it's gotten lost.
It seems like people are really in search of ways to expand their culinary horizons and ways to learn about new ingredients and new techniques and new kinds of food. And the internet is obviously a huge part of that. I think one of the things that draws people to subscription services is that they're being sent things they might not go out and buy. But I think that unless you've developed a filter to really contextualize all of that information that's so readily available, it's very hard, in fact, to become a better cook when you're surrounded by all of these different ingredients all the time and all of this information. I know that in addition to this incredible career as a chef and author, you have also been a very serious cookbook collector. And I think of cookbooks as being one of the ways that people can sort of filter and focus on the great things that are happening in food without being distracted by all of the noise. Are there new cookbooks coming out that you've been impressed by, or are there older ones that you continue to go back to?
Well, you know, I'm old-fashioned in the sense that I tell my students and customers, and when I was giving classes, that the prefaces to the Escoffier's Le Guide Culinaire about how to make a chicken, how to make stocks, have never been improved on until you get to the really far-out techniques of molecular cuisine, that kind of thing. But that is still based on knowing the pure, traditional, simple way of making a chicken stock. Then you can put it into any machine you want and turn it into a chicken stock vapor if you want to. And, you know, hovering over poached chicken breast, a chicken vapor might be absolutely wonderful and fun and interesting and great to look at. But you have to learn to make the chicken stock first. So I rely, and I tell everybody, you're never going to get better advice on how to make a chicken stock than in that ancient, well, 1908 book. But then, since then, you know, I tend to go to wonderful how-tos with photographs of how to do things, because I want to know how to make chicken vapor. You know, I was never taught how to do that. So I like the basic books and then the books that take all the basics and play with them. In other words, I mean, the book that I would like to write next is marrying Indian cuisine with Yucatecan Mexican cuisine, because mole and curry, in my mind, are just waiting to be put together and written about.
I think it's so important to focus on the point that cooking is really, like many other things, the development of skills. And it's important to learn the basics before you learn how to experiment, that having that foundation is really what allows chefs to do what they do and make incredible new things happen in the kitchen.
By the way, summer may already be half over, but you can still enjoy it thanks to our new podcast, QDT Block Party, Tips for Your Best Summer Ever. Listen at itunes.com/QDT.
What are some of your favorite kitchen shortcuts that are really adaptable for home cooks?
Well, the best shortcut that ever invented was the food processor, A dish that was thrown out with the baby with the dishwater, you know, the bathwater, or quenelle, that French fish mousse that were then, you know, cooked in cream or crayfish sauce or lobster sauce or something, you know. I mean, I think that, you know, La Grenouille is probably the last restaurant in New York that even thought about it in the last 40 years, but it is one of the world's divine dishes. But am I going to grind up a lot of Dovasole in a mortar and pestle and then put it through a very fine sieve and then beat it all up, you know, with, yes, but maybe once a year. On the other hand, with a food processor, you're 10 minutes away. Lots of people would say a blender. I think a blender is actually, apart from milkshakes, is probably the worst thing that ever came into a kitchen, because it oxidizes and heats up and changes the food, whereas the food processor is the next best thing, doing it by hand. If you make a mayonnaise or an aioli, garlic mayonnaise, in a mortar and pestle, you know, it's light, it's very digestible, it's, you know, you don't feel heavy afterwards. You make it in a blender and it's sort of oily and thick and greasy, and you sort of burp it up for 24 hours. It's got to be with violence. There should be no violence in the kitchen.
It's very good advice. So I thought we'd do a little bit of a speed round. I'm just going to give you quick prompts and the first thing you think of. Favorite secret ingredients?
Fenugreek.
What was the last great thing you ate?
Sea urchin souffle.
What are things that you never eat, if any?
Canned berries.
What is your favorite fictional meal?
The one that I wrote saying was the one that I wanted to do, which was held in a, well, this is not a quick bite. In a villa in the winter in Venice. And we went through the whole thing. And then at the end, there were three people way down the other end of this vast room smoking Romeo and Julietas. So they would, you would get the aroma of the cigars, but not the nastiness of somebody sitting next to you and smoking them.
And my last one, I think you already answered, which was must-have kitchen gadgets. It's nice to see someone stand up for the food processor because I feel like that's sort of an unsung hero. But are there any others that you rely on?
Let me think of that. Well, a corkscrew.
Absolutely. There's no good kitchen without a corkscrew.
I just did 4th of July without a corkscrew, and I had to use my old technique, which horrified everybody, was you take the handle of a wooden spoon and you put a towel over the cork, and then you force the wooden spoon handle down into the bottle, and some wine spurts out and the cork goes down. It worked.
That's all that matters. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much for inviting me.
Tune in next time on The Clever Cookster for more tips and tricks from the kitchens of the world's best cooks.